Welcome to Our Story, Your Story, the video podcast where we share our personal experiences and invite you to share yours. We are Toby Yunus and Shelley Carney, and together we'll take you on a journey through our lives and the lives of our family, friends, and guests. We believe that everyone has a story to tell, and we can all learn from each other's experiences. So whether you're looking for inspiration, entertainment, or simply a good story, you've come to the right place. Hello, and welcome to Our Story, Your Story. This is a brand new program for us. And in our first episode, we're just going to very briefly tell you what we're doing, why we're doing it, and then jump right into the story. So what we're doing is Toby and I will be telling stories. We're going to start off with stories from Toby's life. Then we'll, you know, have sort of an interview chat session that expands on that story and give you the opportunity to add comments to our YouTube videos or our podcast. And then we will, after we get through our stories, which we're going to start with our book that we wrote, A Gypsy's Kiss, A Treasure Hunt Adventure. We wrote this book. It's got lots of Toby stories in it. We're going to begin by reading a chapter from the book each week and expanding on those stories within those chapters.
What do you want them to do about all this?
What we want them to do is to show up, watch the videos, comment on the videos, share them with your family and friends. And then you can also email us with your stories at stories at
AGKmedia.studio.
Yeah. And then eventually, when we get through our stories, we'll start looking for guests who have really great stories to share.
And bring them on the show.
Yeah. Hmm. And who are you?
I'm Toby Yunus. I'm the other person on this.
He's the guy who wrote the book.
With your help.
Yes.
But I have a point to make.
Okay.
Because some people already know about what's happening in your life. I feel like what's happening in your life right now is much more of a story than going back to my stuff when I was a kid.
Yeah, but it's easier to tell a story once you've been all the way through it, right? When you're on the other side of it and you can look back and say, and here's what I learned from that, and here's what I would have done differently. And, you know, you can analyze it at that point. But when you're in the middle of it, it's more emotional. You don't know, you know, you're very uncertain about where it's headed. So there's not a beginning, middle, and end to it yet, because I'm still in the middle of it.
All right. I will follow your lead on all of this.
Yeah. So we like to follow the story structure, the hero's journey. You know, a story is basically something happens to a person that creates an obstacle, and they try to overcome that obstacle to get to their goal. And that's kind of what each chapter does, as well as the entire story. And any good story will have those things involved in it.
There's a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah, absolutely. But within the beginning, middle, and end, things are happening.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So we're going to start with chapter one from A Gypsy's Kiss, A Treasure Hunt Adventure by Toby Yunus and Shelley Carney. You can also get your own copy of this book on Amazon. If you have Kindle Unlimited, you can read it for free, or you can purchase the paperback copy if you like. You ready?
Why don't you tell the folks why you're reading my book and not me?
Toby's more comfortable listening than he is reading aloud. How about that? Does that sound about right?
You think with that good Catholic education, I'd know how to read.
So while I'm reading, Toby, I'd like you to be reminiscing, going back in time, thinking about how you felt when you were this age, the things that were going on in your life, what brought you to that point, and, you know, just basically what were your philosophies in life?
I'm going to make notes.
Okay. Are we ready? Okay. Chapter one, English class. The speeding projectile strikes Brother Terence in the center of his chest. A plume of white mist sprays out in front of him. He peers down to survey the damage, then puts his hands over the wound as if he is trying to hide it. He glares up at me with accusing eyes. He knows the shot was meant for me. It's 1964, and I'm in the second half of my sophomore year at St. Michael's High School in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm standing in front of Brother Terence's English class, attempting to recite William Cullen Bryant's Thanatopsis from memory. When thoughts of the last bitter hour, this is definitely a bitter hour. My knees and my voice are shaking uncontrollably like aspens in high winds. I scan the room and notice that, much like aspen trees interconnected by their root system, my nervous energy is infecting others. I can tell by their restlessness and fidgeting, they sense their own impending catastrophe, mirroring mine, will take place soon. Come like a blight over thy spirit and sad images of the stern agony. Time slows as the next series of events etch my brain. John Baca, a Neanderthal of a lineman on our football team, nicknamed Tank, stands up, takes a chalk-covered felt eraser from the blackboard behind him, and hurls it at a high rate of speed in my direction. Tank eagerly dives headfirst into every opportunity to bully and intimidate anybody intellectually superior and physically smaller. This applies to almost every student at St. Michael's, since Tank is over 6 feet tall and athletically muscled. It's as if his main objective in life is to give everyone a reason to dislike him. He dares them to defy his perception that the world is a heartless void that leans toward survival of the fittest. Deftly jerking my body to the right, the eraser whizzes past my left ear. I was always quick like that. It strikes Brother Terence in the center of the chest of his black cassock. Shock turns to anger when he sees the dust cloud of chalk spreading from the rectangular white tattoo on his chest. He stands up with great intensity, enough to push his rolling chair off the back of the riser, sending it crashing into the wall and creating a tremendous racket. He raises his floor-length cassock above the knees, which is an indication that he is about to run, and yells at Tank, "I will kill you for that!" Surprised gasps bubble up around the classroom, bringing every boy to full attention as we register these words, destroying our previous impression of the meek Christian Brother Terence. Terence charges toward the back of the room. Tank clumsily lurches out from his desk and opens the door to his left with such force that it shatters the glass in the upper half as it smashes against the wall. He leaps from the room, sprinting down the long hall as fast a speed as he can muster. He is chased by the steadily seething black-robed force of nature that is our normally serene, ascetic English teacher. The hallway echoes the last words we will hear on the matter, Terence shouting what sounds like to me, "Baca, you dumb shit! I'll kill you when I get my hands on you!" But I suppose I could be wrong about that. Greatly relieved of the effort of reciting Thanatopsis, I return to my desk. Boys slide papers into notebooks and tuck away their pens as the last minutes of class tick around the clock. The end of session bell rings and we hasten to our next class. Cordovan penny loafers and black or white Converse high tops tramp and crunch their way across the broken glass in the doorway as we turn up and down the hall. So that was chapter one. Why did you choose to start with that particular event?
I would say there are at least two reasons. Number one, I needed a hook. Mm-hmm. It's my book. And I wanted a hook that people would at least get through the first chapter and think to themselves, well, I got to find out what's going on here. And the hook was this true story. John was his real first name. Baca was not. And he was known as Tank. Mm-hmm. He was just big. And he was a bully. I was going to say a bit of a bully, but he wasn't. He was a bully. He bullied everyone. He had a couple of friends on the basketball team. I'm sorry, on the football team. But you couldn't get by a day without him doing something that would be designed to irritate you. It's like he wanted attention. Mm-hmm. So that made part of that story. That was a good part of the story. And secondly, I wanted it to be something other than a boy's life at an all-boys Catholic boarding school, mm-hmm. right? Which is, you know, there's not a lot to talk about except from your own perspective. The other thing is we have to do it in the context of the hero's journey. And in the opening of the hero's journey, the first three chapters or so have to define, are designed to define who you are in the context of the world in which you exist. And my world at that time, my entire world at that time was St. Michael's High School. Yeah, I had a family and I had brothers and sisters, but my life was in St. Michael's High School. And so that's why I chose that event, because it had everything in it. It had the other students. It had Tank, our school bully. It had Brother Thomas, who was our English teacher.
And who we called Terrence in the book.
I'm sorry. Am I allowed to do that?
Yeah, why not? Yeah. I mean, all these people have passed away.
Yeah, they definitely
have. You've outlived most all
and
of
he
them,
was,
as far as we know.
He was the most, he was the quietest of all our teachers, right? And I just remember doing a lot of standing up in various forms of public speaking in front of the class, because he demanded that. That's what he wanted us to do. And over the years, I mean, that was my sophomore year. By the time I was a senior, between that and the Forensic Society, I was a hell of a speaker. Mm-hmm. And that was mostly due to Thomas's insistence that we get up in front of class and speak.
Yes. Sophomore oral expression. Sophomores usually are introduced to public speaking in mm-hmm. high school mm-hmm. at that point. And you have people who are quite good at it. And then you have people who are just horrible. Mm-hmm. And some people even have some background in it. Mm-hmm. They'll come in and they're just outstanding. Mm-hmm. For instance, in our class, we had a group of students who also had Future Farmers of America classes, and they were required to know Robert's Rules of Order and to get up and speak and to have vivacious dynamic meetings using Robert's Rules of Order. So they were raised to know how to behave in a society where you are expected to know how to do public speaking, maybe even go on into politics because you had the understanding of those kinds of meetings. So I think that was a really good way to introduce young people to that fear that most people have, mm-hmm. a fear of standing up and talking in front of groups. And the best way to get over it is to practice doing it in front of a group of people that is your peers, that you know, that you feel more comfortable with, and then moving on from there. Mm-hmm. It sounds like that's what you did.
It was. I mean, I was already in the Forensics Society, and I was on the debate side. And the reason I wanted to be on the debate side is because it's very rationally organized. You know, you had 4 minutes worth of your presentation, followed alternatively, and you were in a team of two. And then you'd finish up with each person having 2 minutes worth of rebuttal. And then you were judged on that. But you were working from cards and things that you had put together in order to make that presentation. It wasn't completely extemporaneous. By my junior year, I started doing the extemporaneous speaking. Mm-hmm. And that was when those were the guys that carried around suitcases full of Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, et cetera, because they'd give you a topic before the competition started. Mm-hmm. And you had to take all that information and turn it into an 8-minute standing presentation. And so I got progressively better at that. And what was interesting to me is that it influenced that ability for public speaking. And honestly, as I grew older, the joy of public. I really looked forward to public speaking. I loved every opportunity I would get to speak in public, I would. And they knew that, and they could tell how much I was excited by it. I think they even attended a couple. Occasionally, I'd have to get up at at their schools to make a presentation or something like that. So they see, and it influenced them.
Them who?
My children. Mm. And they were influenced by it. And although none of them ever joined the Forensic Society, they all became good, confident speakers in high school and are still like that. They don't have any problem getting up in front of an audience and either speaking or singing or whatever they plan to do.
Yeah. So.
But it was a good influence. So, but I think the important part about this the beginning of this story was that it established my world. Mm-hmm. St. Michael's High School students and teachers, you know, mostly Christian brothers. I think we had one or two, maybe three lay teachers at most. Mm-hmm. And two of those were actually coaches that, you know, earned additional income by teaching classes like typing and drafting. We had to take drafting class. So
tell us a little encapsulated from the time of being a child up till you hit St. Michael's High School.
So my childhood was relatively, I had two brothers and a sister, all younger than me. And we were wonderful siblings with one another. We had a great mom and a great dad, and everything was going along. My father he and his brothers owned car dealerships, and everything was going along swimmingly until I was 11, and then my father died. And
in a plane crash
along with his two brothers. So the family lost all the males in one fell swoop. And
that side of the family.
The Eunice side of the family, that's right. And the most difficult part of all that was they called my mother to let her know what happened because the Eunices were from Taos. And they told her, they didn't tell her why, but they asked her to come up to Taos. And it was like night. So she called one of my uncles and asked if he would drive her up there. And when she got there, they told her what had happened. Well, this was December 7th. That happened on December 7th. And it snowed that day and for the next 4 days. So not only could she not leave Taos, you've seen the Taos Road. Well, imagine that road when it was two lanes and not improved and no rails and things like that. So not only could she not get out of Taos, we couldn't get to Taos. So for 6 days, we knew only that we didn't have a father, without any explanation or any way to say goodbye. So it affected each of us. And I am often reminded by my own daughter that I shouldn't be critical of the lives my brothers and sisters led because they were less than perfect. Because she would remind me they lost their dad too. And so I had to learn how to forgive them for their travails, you know, rather than because they did. They were all younger. I was the oldest at 11, and Rita was 15 months younger than me, and Vincent was 15 months younger than her, and Paul was 4 years younger than Vincent. Paul was 5 when all this happened. So the effect of losing your father is people who have lost their fathers when they're very young can have an effect on you. It affected me by kind of closing me up, and I became rebellious, but not in a violent way. And that's when my mother, with the counseling from the local priest, Monsignor Rabbit, suggested that they send me to St. Michael's High School. Now, we always went to Catholic schools anyway. But and the plan was that one day I would go to St. Michael's, or all the boys would, and Rita went to Loretto. And Loretto wasn't a boarding school, St. Michael's was. So I didn't go as a day student, I went as a boarding student. And so I lived the life of a boarding student at St. Michael's, even though my family was 2 miles away from me and, you know, down Agua Fria.
Now, when you lost your father, did your uncle step in? Did you have male role models that you could look to?
I feel like, although I don't think of them as stepping in, we were always, the Delgados were all very close anyway. I mean, we're all Santa Feanos, you know. And so they were close. And I saw a lot of my uncles anyway. But, and at the time, they weren't married yet. They were single. I remember especially Ernesto, Edmundo, Carlos. Uncle Albert was away, still in the military. But the three of them were still single. And so I was involved in a lot of things. I learned how to build a boat with my Uncle Carlos. I learned ham radio from my Uncle Mundi. I learned industrial art from my Uncle Carlos, you know, creating art from with paint and brushes, other than with paint and brushes. So they were the first major influences in terms of masculinity in my life. By the time I got to the Christian Brothers were this odd mix of religious and secular. You know, they weren't priests. They were teachers, and they just happened to wear a cassock. And as a matter of fact, later on in life, I discovered that many of them had gone back to a secular life. You know, rather than be Christian Brothers, they wanted to, Brother Godfrey became a documentary filmmaker, you know, things like that. But they were the next best influence on me. There was a point at which I didn't have that kind of influence. There was one teacher in college that I had a great deal of respect for, but in college, I didn't have that. And then when I quit school in my senior year, when I quit college in my senior year, I went to the military. And somehow or the other, in almost every unit in all my travels, because I was in the first year and a half, 2 years, I was in seven different locations in the military before I went to Vietnam. And invariably, I would run into someone, a NCO, non-commissioned officer, rarely an officer, mostly non-commissioned officers, that were older, that had been in the military, most of them, or if they hadn't been there as lifers, they were going to be. And I'd run into one of them that I could talk to and learn from. And so I had the male influence that was, I want to say organized, but I don't think that's the right word. It was structured. And so that helped me look at masculinity from that perspective. And also it created an awareness of responsibilities of manhood, of being an older, you're not a kid anymore. You enter the army. I was about to turn 20 when I entered the military. And what you find out in the military, and right away, because they knew I was older and I was there with a bunch of 18-year-olds, I started making rank, you know, just because I was more mature, basically. And I wasn't fighting it. I wasn't, a lot of people going to the military, especially during that time, the time of Vietnam, there was a lot of draftees. They wanted to fight it. They didn't, you know, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to fight it. So I made rank very easily. And with the help of these NCOs, I learned a lot about myself, about the man's role in society, and especially the man's role when it came to family. And some of those lessons I still stick with me. I remember there was this one command sergeant major at Fort Devens, and he was the youngest command sergeant major in the Army. And he was in his mid to late 20s, which is an amazing. Command sergeant major is the highest rank you can get. He was non-commissioned officer. And he was the one that when I said, Sergeant Major, could you tell me, you know, tell me how you became the youngest command sergeant major in the Army? And he said, he put down his pen and he looked up and he said, I took every shit job that nobody else wanted. And that question and answer established a bond between me and him that lasted the whole time I was at Fort Devens. But at some point, he got me another rank. He actually promoted me, had me promoted. But at one point, he was having a gathering at his house, a family gathering, a barbecue. And he invited me and a couple of other of the junior NCOs to the party. And I just watched him interacting with his family. And up to this time, to me, he had been this kind of scary figure that gave orders, like he knew exactly what he was doing and knew exactly what you should be doing after he gave the order. And I just imagined he was like that all the time. And when I saw him with his family, and it was like, you know, there was no child that was older than seven. And there were four of them, two boys and two girls. And he treated the girls like
princesses.
Like they were little princesses. And the boys like they were little men. And it was just, it was like a really good, a good sense of what a family should look like, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that was one of the things that influenced me a lot from them. But yeah, like, and I guess anybody who's lost one of their parents early in life can say, well, that changed my life. Mm-hmm. And it was rough for the first couple of years because I was being very rebellious and I was blaming my father. You know, I couldn't make amends with him. I didn't get to see a funeral. I didn't get to see the casket. Not that there would have been anything in the casket. I got to see none of that. And it really had a negative impact on my mother as well. And not only the children, it didn't show up until later, you know, in their teen years. My mother, you know, because of her wonderful love for my father, it just tore her insides out. And she spent the first 2 years looking for ways not to have to think about it. You know, she went back to making tin work and she went back to teaching. She did all these things that she hadn't done for years, but needed to keep her mind busy. And she did, you know, some people would say, well, your brothers and sisters turned out because your mom, my mom did the best that she could, even though, like I said, I was being rebellious and I kind of resented it. I didn't make amends with my father until I came back from Vietnam the first time. And then I drove up to Taos and they had, although there was empty caskets to bury, they had their own plot. The Eunice plot in this one cemetery. And I went to that cemetery and, you know, made amends with my father.
So this particular chapter focuses on an interaction between you, your teacher, and the school bully. Mm-hmm. Did you encounter other bullies in your life? And did you look back on situations with Tank as a way to deal with these things?
So the mistake that I probably made early in life is I didn't deal with Tank, right? Because he was so big and so intimidating and he was just so angry and mean at everything. You just didn't want to. Here's an interesting story. He went on later in life. I don't know if he ever joined the military, but he went back to Santa Fe and he became a police officer. And then he became an undercover police officer. And at some point, there was a drug raid, and a person took his own gun away from him and killed him with it. And that seemed wrong to me. You know, it seemed like he had done the turnaround, becoming a police officer and getting into undercover. Anyway, what I learned about bullies is two things. Number one, they bully you because they think they can bully you. And number two, for the most part, if you stand up to them, you can get them to stop bullying you. And in some cases, you can get them to at least respect you, if not become friends, at least. Okay, well, that's somebody I don't want to mess with.
Is that something that happened to you that you
did? It happened in basic training. And there was another guy, he was from California, and he was a little bit bigger than me. And he was always looking for a way to set things off. And this is by this time, we were in a room with 8 beds, so 4 beds separated by half walls, et cetera, et cetera. And he was the guy on the other end of my bed. And at some point there was he started an issue and this was, I don't know, 6 weeks into 8 weeks worth of basic training. And he started an issue and he got up and he said, well, let's just have this out. And I got up and I got into what is this basic standard hand-to-hand combat fighting position. And I looked at him and waited for him to come at me. Now, he was bigger than me. He weighed more than me. I was about 145 pounds at that point. I'm only 5'6". I wasn't anywhere near the size he was. And I got into that position and he looked at me for a second. And he said something like, we'll finish this some other time. And he stepped back and he went back to lay in his bed. And that was one of those, that was the instance where I realized all you have to do is look like you're going to stand up for yourself. And sometimes it got loud. There have been other times and other situations where a bully tried to respond. And what I had to do was yell back at the bully at the top of my lungs. Now, that hasn't happened often. I could probably count it on two fingers of one hand. But I realized that if you let them, if you allow them to bully you without responding to it, they're going to bully you. If you respond to it, bullies, well, I want to make a difference. I want to make the distinction between bullies and psychopaths, right?
Yeah.
Bullies, you can lift yourself up, make whatever you need to do to let them know that you're not going to tolerate whatever they think they're going to do to you, and they'll step back. They may never become your friend, and they may try it on occasion, but for the most part, they'll leave you alone from that point forward. And it was a good lesson, and I've used it often since then to the extent that I don't even think about it. There was a point in life where I didn't even think about it. You know, mm-hmm. I could spot a bully a mile away. I could give him that look like, I know you're a bully. Mm-hmm. Don't mess with me.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't mess with you. I mean, yeah. I don't remember a lot of situations after early in the military that I could call myself bullied. You know, there was an E6 NCO, staff sergeant at jump school. And he bullied, that was just his style. And once you accepted that it wasn't personal, that he's just trying to make sure that you survive every jump, you know. There was another one in basic training, Sergeant Barinki. He was from the Philippines. He was, I don't know, 4 inches shorter than me. But he could be so damn intimidating. He would come up and tell you all the reasons the Vietnamese were going to be killing you, you know, all the ways the Vietnamese were going to kill you if you didn't listen to him. I'm not going to do his accent because I don't do it well, but he'd always say, I'm going to keep you alive. You don't listen to me, the VC going to kill you. Now how could you argue with that?
Yeah, so logical. Well, as you were talking about bullies, I did remember a couple of situations in my own life where I had to respond. I remember one day in PE, and it was in eighth grade, and there was a girl. She was next to me, and she kept bumping into me, and I could tell she was doing it on purpose. Mm-hmm. And finally, I turned to her, I grabbed the front of her shirt, and I said, do you have a problem? Or do we have a problem? Or something to mm-hmm. that effect, you know? And she backed down immediately. Well, I found out later through the grapevine that she was unhappy that I was hanging out with a boy that she liked. And he liked me, mm-hmm. and that didn't sit well with her. So she was, you know, trying to pick a fight with me. But when I came back at her, you know, stood up to her, then she backed down. Now, there were other times in my life where people bullied me or kind of tried to say bad things behind my back mm-hmm. to other people. And they didn't ever confront me physically or come up to my face and say things. They always were snidely, sneakily, snakily, mm-hmm. you know, talking behind my back or just doing stupid, mean things. So they were just mean girls, but they weren't in my face about it. So I never confronted them really. And it continued for years with these people. And, you know, and I think back now, and maybe I should have just, mm-hmm. you know,
approached them
and said, you know, why, and knock it off, and, you know, something to that effect. But because I never really understood their reasons either. So that always was like, what did I don't even hardly know these people. Why mm-hmm. are they, you know? So there's different ways to handle it, of course. Chasing him down the hall, maybe not.
Not one of them, no. One of the things, and Brother Thomas, had he caught Tank, mm-hmm. he'd have probably gotten there, except that Tank wouldn't strike a brother. Mm. You know, but if Tank had turned on him, he could have easily handled him. So, but one of the things I was going to say is one of the reasons I think I haven't had a lot of trouble with bullies, like after my first year of the military, where people are just trying to prove themselves in a variety of different ways, is that I can I recognize them now. And I don't allow myself to become ensnared in the various traps that they set for people, you know, and I let them know that I know.
Yeah,
I think you can let them know, like, I know where you're coming with this. Just
do you think sometimes the bullies that were, you know, around in high school turned into bullies on, you know, trolls on the internet?
You know what? It wouldn't surprise me in the least, because it seems to be. I had a conversation once with a friend of mine who was a shrink, and we got into this about the nature of the internet and why it was like that. And we ended up talking about people that were trolls and why they're like that. A bully and a troll have something going on in their lives that you and I, A, probably haven't experienced, and B, wouldn't understand. You know, it's just their way of expressing the frustration they're experiencing with whatever is happening in their lives. And they want to take it out on something or someone. That's why bullies don't have pets, right? It's rare that you see them with pets, because the pets don't last long.
So that makes me ask the question, were you a bully?
That's a good question. I mean, because I don't have pets?
You didn't have pets? Well, we'll talk about that in the book later.
Well, I didn't have pets. I didn't have, the kids all had pets. I just don't like taking care of them. I think it's, let's not get into that.
But were you a bully?
Yeah. I've never thought of myself as a bully as much as I've thought of myself as, confidently assertive. Maybe that's the best way to describe it. I mean, I've never felt like I've never gone out of my way to bully someone, but I have taken directions where I was making my own decisions, doing things my own way. And you have a choice whether to do it with me or not. Mm-hmm. And if you choose not to, I'm not going to bully you into joining me. It was everybody has a right to make whatever choices they want.
And I've heard some of your stories, and I would say from the stories that you've told me, you were more of a protector. If somebody was being bullied, you were more likely to step in and protect them.
Yeah. Well, a lot of times I didn't have the physical size necessary to do it, but I could always find a way to interject. If you don't focus on the bully, but focus on the victim, however they were. I mean, I had a good friend in elementary school that had been afflicted with muscular dystrophy. And so he was, for lack of a better way to describe it, his name was Larry, and he was misshapen. And he was tall. He was tall, but he didn't have control over his arms. His legs were bent. And people would find, and he had braces on his legs, and people would find ways to be mean to him, including knocking him over because, you know, he had a hard time getting up. And so I found myself in elementary school just hanging around with Larry to make sure that nobody went out of their way to pick on him. And so, yeah, not that if somebody, you know, wanted to, they couldn't. There was, I had my elementary school bully was Lorenzo. And he used to get mad that he was two grades ahead of me. And he used to get mad that I was always protecting Larry. And what was interesting about this guy, and I didn't like him. Anytime I'd see him, I'd go the other side of the street or whatever it was. The interesting thing about this guy is he became an attorney and then eventually a judge. And he ended up the judge in my first divorce case in Santa Fe. And I thought to myself, oh, this is going to be terrible for me. He was actually very fair. I don't know if he remembered me or not, but the minute I was up there, I realized, ugh.
Your nemesis.
I told my attorney, I said, I have something to tell you about this judge. And she said something like, have you had a previous case with him? And I said, well, I guess you could call it that, you know? So it was pretty
pre-judge
funny.
Life.
Yeah, pre-judge life. So.
Well, I think that is where we're going to wrap up for the evening. We hope that you got some entertainment and some enjoyment out of this story. If you have been in a bullying situation and you got out of it in a very creative way, we would love to hear your story. So we hope that you'll write to us either in the comments or by emailing us at stories@agkmedia.studio. We'd love to hear more about that. And if we get really good stories that you write to us, we may share them on our show later in the season.
Mm-hmm. And maybe bring you on so you can tell those stories.
If you'd like.
Shelley, yes. I think I learned this from Shelley. I'm not sure. she'll probably tell me that I didn't learn it from her, that I learned it from someplace else. But there's a saying in the movie business, and that is tragedy plus time equals comedy. And so now I can look back at all these times in my life that were what I would call difficult at the time and look back at them with a sense of humor. Yes, I lost my father when I was 11, but I can tell you all the good things that came out of that as a result. And finally, how I reconciled the fact that I did. So that's true of everybody. Tragedy plus time equals comedy. So the best way to tell a story from your past is to look at it from A, how has it changed you? B, how has it made you better? And C, what was funny about that situation? Not that there's anything funny about losing a parent, but the life you led from that point forward had to have some humor in it. If it didn't, you wouldn't be telling these stories. And that's where the stories come from. The stories come from a way to look at your life in a funny way.
And that's a good place to wrap it up. Thank you for joining us. And please do make sure you subscribe. Share our channel with your family and friends, because we're just starting this out as an experiment, and we hope that it really takes off. And, you know, comment or send us an email. We'd love to hear from you.
Let us know. And let us know what you think about storytelling.
Thanks for listening to Our Story, Your Story. We hope you enjoyed hearing our stories and those of our guests. We invite you to share your own stories with us by emailing us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. Until next time, keep telling your story, because your story matters.